Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
Hello, everyone. I hope you're having a beautiful day wherever you are.
Beautiful day in the neighborhood.
Yeah, right.
So, we had fun reading this week, didn't we, Mom?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Talk about a page-turner. I mean, come on.
So why don't you introduce our guest?
Okay, I will do that. Our book today is, Etiquette for Runaways, and our author is Liza Nash Taylor, and she was a 2018 Hawthornden International Fellow and received her MFA from Vermont College of Fine Arts, the 2016 winner of the San Miguel Writers' Conference Fiction Prize. Her work has appeared in Microcondia 2, Gargoyle Magazine, and Deep South, amongst others. A native Virginian, she lives in Keswick with her husband and dogs. So, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Monica and Caroline. I'm delighted to be on Writers' Voices.
So, the title of this book is Etiquette for Runaways. And
yes.
It wasn't quite what I expected when I got into it.
No, it wasn't. Right, me either.
What did you expect?
I think I was expecting a contemporary fiction. And particularly because of the cover. She just looked contemporary to me. But it's not. It's historical fiction, and it's set in the Jazz Age in Virginia and New York and Paris. So tell us a little bit about the kind of the impetus behind Etiquette for Runaways.
Well, I knew I wanted to write a historical novel, and in beginning a novel, an author makes three basic decisions: the setting, the characters, and especially for historical fiction, the time period. So as far as the setting goes, it was this time of year, the dog days of summer in Virginia, and I had very recently broken my right ankle. So I was stuck at home in my old house. We live in a circa 1830 Virginia farmhouse. So the decision as to where to begin the story was pretty easy. I couldn't go anywhere, but from where I was sitting on the porch, I could look out and see the Southwest Mountains and smell newly cut hay. And I knew, this place has some history. Albemarle County, Virginia, definitely has some history.
And you've lived there your whole life?
I grew up in Virginia Beach and then went to school at Mary Baldwin College and then lived in New York and Nantucket. And then when I married the second time, I moved back here about 27 years ago.
You know, it's funny because I'm actually reading or listening to another book set in Virginia right now, which was Water Dancer by Tehachapi and Coates. It's set in slave times. And it's a fabulous, fabulous book. So there's something about Virginia that's calling to me, those country roads. So why this particular time period?
Well, I was trying to decide when to set the book. And I was, of course, I had the constraints of the age of the house, so 1830 to present. And I was trying to decide what would be an interesting era to write about here where I live in Albemarle. And the 20s kept sort of running through my mind. Number one, I love the period. I love Art Deco. I love the fashion and the music. And there was a lot going on here. There was moonshining going on here, and nearby Franklin County, about 2 hours from here, during Prohibition, was called the moonshine capital of the world. So, in Albemarle here, there was a moonshiner named Bose Shiflett, and he operated out of Bacon Hollow, and he was known as the King of the Blue Ridge. So so when you come across a little Easter egg like that in research, it has to have a cameo.
So in Etiquette for Runaways, your protagonist is a young woman named May Marshall. And she is living on this, basically in your house, I guess. Is that true?
Yes.
So she's living in your house. Her father's a grocer, but he's also a moonshiner. Now, was that, we think of moonshiners as being, you know, kind of the people with not too many teeth living up in the mountains. But is it more historically accurate that it was maybe tradespeople and you know, leading citizens doing it too?
Well, that's an interesting question. In my imagination, the Marshall family has started the Keswick Market, which is sort of the one pump filling station country market of the, you know, in the area. And they also have an orchard business where they make jams and jellies and so forth. But I do imagine Henry Marshall having teeth.
Yeah, I thought he was fairly well-to-do, fairly established.
But, you know, all people from all walks of life were breaking the law during Prohibition. I don't know if you know the difference between a bootlegger and a moonshiner.
Well, I think a moonshiner was making the alcohol and a bootlegger was importing it, transporting it, selling it in some way.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes, on the black market. Yes, and in fact, in the house where my brother-in-law used to live, which is two farms over from us, when they moved in, they found in the living room floor two trap doors that were installed during Prohibition to hide illegal alcohol.
Yeah, the whole idea of making it illegal just seems kind of foolish, although there are nations even to this day that where alcohol is illegal. Are there any dry counties left in the U.S.?
You know, there might be. I think I have heard of some in Alabama or Kentucky. I'm not sure. I don't want to live in one.
Me neither. Okay, so now May has gotten herself into a bit of trouble to start out.
Yes.
And her father gets himself into a bit of trouble. There's really a lot of trouble going on throughout this book.
There is a sort of a constant stream of trouble, and things fall into May's lap that she didn't ask for. And her character is actually inspired by Daniel Defoe's 1722 novel, Moll Flanders, which I had read shortly before I broke my ankle and started this book.
And
so Moll Flanders sort of, as she's coming of age, people try to take advantage of her, especially men. And Moll is wily and clever, and she finds ways to get ahead and to get even, and she doesn't always follow the rules. And that really appealed to me. And I loved this very early novel when you think about it. 1722, that's 100 years before Jane Austen was publishing her first novel.
And the idea that that a man writing during that time, I assume Daniel Defoe was actually a man. Sometimes people who wrote as men weren't, but that he would have a female protagonist is kind of surprising in a way.
He first marketed it as a cautionary autobiography, and but you know he was a bestseller of the time, and people pretty quickly pinned it on him that he had written this story, and it was supposedly based on a true story.
Okay, so he was writing it under a pen name originally, pretending to be a woman.
Exactly.
You know, it's interesting because we've had a couple authors on recently, men who were writing from a female point of view, and there's times when I feel like the character, although they were both very good books and very wonderful authors, that I wasn't sure they totally got it, the woman's perspective, or at least it wasn't a woman that I would necessarily identify with.
Right. Yeah, I've had that experience in reading, too.
Yeah. So, but do you think Daniel Defoe got it right?
Well, I just liked, I liked this girl's nerve, and I just thought it was sort of refreshing to me to read about a heroine who makes a lot of mistakes and bad choices.
And so does May.
Yes, indeed.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Liza Nash Taylor, author of Etiquette for Runaways. So how much of this book did you actually write while you were laid up?
Oh, well, it was the first novel I had attempted to write, and I came to the writing game very late, like in my early 50s. Which is funny because I'm hearing about a lot of debut novelists like Alka Joshi, who
I
talked
know.
To recently.
Yeah.
Yes. And I loved The Henna Artist. So I came to writing late and started this novel, and I knew I wanted to finish it once I started it, and I took several writing classes, and then I decided I really, really needed to buckle down and invest in this, and I wasn't working full-time anymore, so I enrolled in a low-residency MFA program at Vermont College of Fine Arts.
And I've heard of that program. So how,
yes,
did, that, how
wonderful.
Did that work?
Well, you go for, it's a two-year program, and each semester you're 10 days on campus in Montpelier, Vermont, and it's just like going back to the grottiest college dormitory you can imagine with bad cafeteria food. But it's a wonderful, wonderful immersive experience. So I went back, you know, at the age of 56, I started this program. And through the program, I worked on this manuscript doing draft after draft. I signed with one agent and spent a year revising with her, and then we sort of parted ways. We couldn't agree on which way the story should go. Then spent another almost a year finding a second agent. So it's really been a process. So as far as and I don't really write outlines. So to answer your question, in the 8 weeks I was at home, I just sort of started writing scenes that came to me, and then that's how I write. I don't write from start to finish. I write scenes, then I write backwards and forwards from those, and some of them end up falling out, and then, you know, some will be tweaked, but then they eventually all string together.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the process of stringing them together. So, it's like, of course, with the computer, it's probably easier than it used to be when, you know, we were writing on paper back in the day.
A lot of writers use this program called Scrivener, where you can save scenes and things. And I've tried it one day, and it made me want to pull my hair out. So I just end up I have sort of one big document, and I divided it into three parts, Virginia, New York, and Paris. And then once I had decided my settings and my characters, I started researching. And in my research, I came across historical events that, and these are what I call Easter eggs, things that can either end up as a little detail of everyday life that I think are interesting, or else it can really turn a plot on its axis. And that has happened in both of my novels. The whole Paris section of this book came about when I started looking into the life of Josephine Baker, who I've always been fascinated by. But when I read about her debut in Paris at the Théâtre des Champs-Élysées in 1925, I knew I wanted to write around that. And I started out using Miss Baker as a character. I didn't write from her perspective. I was writing May's observing her life. And then my then agent said, don't do that because your reader will have expectations and you'll be constrained by the events of Josephine Baker's life. So that was good advice. And I ended up modeling a character, having a character who is inspired by Josephine Baker, and her name is Janie.
Yeah, I like Janie. She was a good one.
Thank you.
So tell us a little bit more about these Easter eggs.
Let me think. There's another one that also shaped the plot, and that was when I read about a trial called the Great Moonshine Conspiracy Trial of 1935. And I was telling you about Franklin County being the moonshine capital of the world, and it was rife with corruption and violence, as you can imagine. But there developed a ring of crooked sheriffs and officials who were defrauding the government out of $5.5 million in whiskey excise taxes. And that's the equivalent of roughly $95 million today. It ended up being the second longest trial in Virginia history. And so I don't go into the trial, and I take that 1935 event. I just used the whole thing of the crooked officials, moved it to 1924, and I was able to use those details. So these officials were shaking down the small moonshiners for protection money when, in fact, the governor of Virginia had told them to leave the small guys alone, just find them, go after the big cases, because the Virginia courts and jails were already full of small operators. Anyway, it was a big trial in its day. So that was an Easter egg I sort of stumbled across. Another one was, I don't know if you saw the Netflix series with Octavia Spencer about Madam C.J. Walker this year. But she was an amazing African-American woman. She was a philanthropist, a businesswoman. And when I read about her academy in Harlem, I knew that I wanted one of my characters to attend that academy. So Rocky, May's friend in New York, is an aspiring hairdresser to the stars, and at night he goes to classes at Madam C.J. Walker's academy.
Ah.
And that was another Easter egg that found its way into the plot.
So, Mom, do you remember, like, in your childhood ever hearing anything about Prohibition time?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe.
Yeah.
I
just looked up. It was between 1920 and 1933. And so, of course, that was before you were born, but not too long before.
Well, I remember hearing about it, of course, of course, when it became legal again, then why everybody was, having a blast, I suppose.
It's really
my parents were social drinkers, but they didn't,
But isn't it interesting though that Prohibition, was the entire 1920s, and yet that was the jazz age, and we have all this.
Yeah.
We think of people as drinking a lot during that time.
I know all these places where they had all the dancing and everything. Yeah,
the speakeasies, which
that's it.
They play a role in your book too. Once May gets to New York.
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, the passage I'm going to read to you takes place in one.
Well, why don't we have you read it? That would be
okay.
Great.
Lovely. So to set this up, it's 1924. May Marshall has arrived in New York, not knowing anyone, not knowing what she's going to do with her life. And the first person she meets is a young man named Rocky. He's an elevator operator at the New York Biltmore Hotel. And he's an aspiring hairdresser, as I told you. So in the scene I'm going to read you, earlier in the day, he has cut off her hair and given her, a 1920s bob, which was so fashionable then. So he's asked her if she'll go out as friends to what they called a black and tan club, where black and white patrons could socialize together. So so in this scene, she's borrowed a dress. Her friend at the rooming house has done her makeup, and she's going out for the first time in New York. And this is from part two. Following Rocky's instructions, May took the L to West 133rd Street. At the Catagonia Club, he waited outside the door, standing tall in a pearl-gray suit and derby hat. May told him that he looked as handsome as Duke Ellington, only without the mustache. Entering the foyer of the club, the outside world seemed to dissolve behind them. While Rocky spoke to the maitre d', she studied her reflection in the entryway mirrors, hardly recognizing the girl who looked back. The girl in the mirror sparkled with anticipation. She was quite glamorous, actually. May stood straighter, lifting her chin. Now the girl looked confident. She gave herself a secret wink. No one would recognize the frightened girl who came on the train from Virginia. The maitre d' led the way through a smoky perfume and liquor-smelling labyrinth, then paused, looking for a table. Even though Rocky had explained the premise of a black and tan club, seeing white people and Negroes sharing tables and dancing together seemed both pioneering and terribly sophisticated. In a corner, a young woman in a fringed silver dress sat on an older man's lap. When she threw back her head, laughing, the feather plume on her headband ruffled and settled. Her companion rolled up a banknote and passed it to her. Leaning forward, the girl's breasts almost spilled from her neckline as she sniffed up a line of powder from the glass tabletop, then whooped, wiping her nose. As she leaned forward again, her eyes caught May's, and she lifted her chin in invitation, holding out the rolled-up bill. May shook her head and looked away, and the girl whooped again. Rocky leaned closer and said, "Cocaine." "She looks like she's having fun," May said. The maitre d' summoned them to a table near the stage and held May's chair. He bowed slightly, then disappeared into the crowd. She leaned forward, covertly watching the girl with the headband. She wanted to absorb every new thing. This sophisticated girl in the ice-blue dress needed some lessons in city life. Mm-hmm. "Have you tried it?" "Yeah," Rocky said. "Makes you feel all jazzed up." He tacked a cigarette out of the pack. "Folks get dependent on it, and it's expensive. Listen, there are plenty of temptations in this world. A thing like that is just the thin end of the wedge. Cigarette?" "No, thanks. What does that mean?" "Well, you try something once, and maybe you like it. Then you try something else, a little bit riskier, and before you know it, you're living on the street. Sometimes things that feel good are dangerous, you know? But you tried it." "I did. That I did. And I can tell you, it was something I had to walk away from." The spotlight surrounding the stage flashed twice. Then the room went black. A saxophone wailed a single, prolonged, mournful note. As it receded into the dark, the crowd was hushed, expectant, for one long beat. 2, 3. With a startling blare of horns, the lights came up, and a line of chorus girls in sparkling costumes kicked and shimmied onto the stage. They kept time operating as a single mechanical force, at once graceful and strong. May tapped her foot to an exuberant thrill of rhythm as vocalists alternated with dance numbers. Each time the chorus appeared in new costumes, she was further enchanted by the beautiful, sweating bodies of the dancers, the swing and glitter of their costumes. The musicians, so obviously enjoying themselves, asking and answering each other through their instruments. She glanced around at the audience, each person either ignoring or picking up the vibration, responding or not responding. There were eyes bright with cocaine, eyes lidded with boredom or drink or both. Rocky was watching her. "You seem to be enjoying yourself." May sat forward eagerly, her palm on her chest. "I've got goosebumps. Oh, thank you for bringing me here. This place it's absolutely magical. The dancers and those gorgeous costumes. You know, my mother designed costumes. You wouldn't believe the work that goes into them. That would be a swell job to have, wouldn't it?" Rocky sat back and crossed his arms, smiling benignantly. You should see your face right now. Why not give it a go? Apply to work in a costume shop. What have you got to lose? With a sudden, vertiginous dropping of her heart, May lowered her hand. What do I have to lose? That, my friend, is a very good question. The nightclub had transported her far away from the world she'd left behind. She toyed with the stem of her glass, saying, I just want a chance, you know, to make something of myself. I want to find where I fit in. Rocky nodded, clinking his glass against hers. Absolutely. Here's to chances, kiddo. I put in 3 applications this week for hairdressing positions. You are going to apply at a costume house. Try for something better than the laundry. May raised her glass. To chances.
And that was Liza Nash Taylor reading from Etiquette for Runaways. So, Mom, what drew you into the story?
Well, I was anxious to see what would happen to her because she was inexperienced and she had this this one friend who was quite wealthy, came from a wealthy family and so forth, and she didn't. And I don't know, it just, and there was always this gentleman that she kind of liked in the background, and he liked her, but, you know, she went to New York and then to Paris and everything, and I don't know, I just wanted to see what was going to happen. But I think the character of Rocky was a wonderful character to have in there, I really do. Because he was a rock. He was a rock for her.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. So. Was it, you know, she came from the South. But she was close to some African Americans in the South, kind of people who worked for her father. Do you think it was uncommon for someone like her to have been so accepting of friendships with people of color in that day and age?
That's a good question. May has grown up in a household raised by an African American housekeeper, pretty much. Her mother left when she was 7. And her father is an alcoholic and he's emotionally unavailable. So she's grown up sort of without the emotional toolbox to stand up for herself and to say no. So she's open and to everyone. And when she goes to New York and Rocky's the first person who befriends her, and then she meets Janie as well, she admires them. She watches them get ahead through their hard work and their drive and their talent. And so she really isn't judgmental. But, you know, it's hard to write about the 1920s or any time in American history without laying over sort of our modern sensibilities, you know, of how people should be treated.
Yeah.
So every instance of racism I cite in the book, I made sure that it came from research, you know, because especially when I was researching Josephine Baker's life, I would come across these incidents that happened to her, and I couldn't gloss over them, but neither did I want to sensationalize them.
Hmm. But they did, obviously, all of them did experience racism, and when May tried to take Rocky shopping, that must have been an interesting thing to write. Interesting scene.
That was hard to write, actually. Yes, and then in Josephine Baker's life, when she was going from New York to Paris on the steamship Berengaria with the troupe of La Revue Negre, she was invited to perform with the orchestra in the first-class lounge on the ship, but she was made to take the service elevator to get there. So, yes. It was definitely happening, and Josephine Baker basically went to Paris and liked it so much better that she never came home. She ended up buying a chateau. She adopted 12 children of all different nationalities and called them her rainbow tribe. She really was quite extraordinary. So these things were happening, and in the entertainment industry, of course. So yeah, I didn't feel like I could leave that out.
Oh, of course. Now, there was still racism in Europe, I'm sure, but maybe in a different, not as much.
No, not as much. You know, Josephine Baker and a lot of African American entertainers went over there and stayed.
And writers,
stayed
too.
World War One. And writers as well, yes.
So let's talk about World War One, because it's over, but it plays a role in the book as well.
That's right. May's neighbor and good friend, the Craig family, lost a son, their oldest son, in France in World War One. And when I was editing the book, the pre-publication edits, the very final polishing edits, I happened to be in France, and I took a day from Paris, and I went to the Ain-Marne American Military Cemetery in Chateau Thierry, France, and it's about an hour on the train. It's at the foot of the Belleisle Wood, which was the site of a huge battle, and there are over 2,200 American graves and a lot of unidentified soldiers. It's a very moving sight if you've ever been to a military cemetery, and it ended up changing the whole end of my book. And no spoilers, but that trip and that experience and that bit of World War One really came in and it hit home with me.
And even at that late a point, you were able to make that material a change?
Well, you kind of have to when your editor says, this ending doesn't feel like an ending to me.
Okay. So now also you have a character who suffers from PTSD from World War One, which...
That's right.
We have this, we kind of have this impression now that all the World War One soldiers were devastated by their experience. Why do you think we think that?
Shell shock.
Yeah. Do you think it was so common that it was everyone, or was it just that for the people who were affected, it was so severe?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, and I don't really think I know the answer to it. I just took I did some research and came up with this character who seems perfectly normal and goes about his business and does his job, and yet he has these episodes of what they then call shell shock, where he just shuts down.
Yeah. Because they call that through the Second World War too, you know.
Yeah.
That's what it was called then.
Right.
So
I'm sure that Civil War soldiers, that throughout history, soldiers have probably always experienced that. But there was something about World War One. I think it had to do with the trenches, the trench warfare, that maybe made it more severe.
And maybe just the new armaments and ammunition and things, you know, the bigger bombs and...
Right, and
air warfare,
exactly.
Yeah, the air war, the air war, absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah, a lot different.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Liza Nash Taylor, author of Etiquette for Runaways. Now, Liza, you mentioned this was your first novel. Had you done other types of writing before?
Well, as I told you, I came late to writing and started, this novel was the first thing I tried. And then I decided that I wrote an essay, and that was published, and then I wrote a flash fiction piece, and that was published by the Harvard Bookstore in an anthology. And then I worked on some short stories, just sort of trying out different forms, but I kept coming back to this novel, and now that I've completed this one and the sequel, I don't think I could go back and get back into that whole form of writing short stories.
Hmm.
Interesting. It's like I've lost it. I'm now just a novelist, and that's how my writing mind works.
So you've already written the sequel?
I have. What happened was, I told you that this one took a while. There were lots of drafts. And when I was in my MFA program, we had to produce a creative thesis, and that would be a novel, or if you were a nonfiction writer, a book of nonfiction or poetry. So I had to start another. I had another project going at the same time, and it ended up being a standalone sequel, meaning it's a dual narrative. May is back. There are some characters that the readers will know, but there's another whole storyline, and it is based around the events. It's set in the Great Depression, 6 years after Etiquette ends, and it's set around the events in 1932 of the Veterans Bonus March on Washington, D.C.
I know nothing about that.
You know, I didn't either, and there's another Easter egg. What happened was in, the Depression, this is at the bottom of the Depression, 1932, and a group of eight veterans in Oregon got together, and they decided they were going to go all the way across the country on foot or riding the rails or hitchhiking, and they were going to petition President Herbert Hoover for the early payment of their war bonuses. And these bonuses were slated to be paid in 1945, but of course everyone was desperate. They didn't have jobs, or they were losing their homes. So they got a lot of press. By the time they got to Washington, D.C., about a month later, there were 14,000. And over the next couple of months, that number grew to 20,000 veterans, bringing their families and camping out around Washington and inhabiting partially demolished office buildings. And the president would not meet with them. But a bill was proposed to pay them early. It was defeated, and many of them stayed on until the end of July when President Hoover got General Eisenhower to clear the camps with tear gas and burning out these shacks. This is where the term Hooverville comes from, a shanty town in the Depression.
Right.
So I write about this summer, and in my imagination, I'm placing a teenage girl there who goes with her father and then is separated. And halfway through the book, she and May will cross paths, and their lives will intersect, and they will influence each other in ways that neither could have imagined.
Wow. Well, you're finding some interesting little bits of history here to a lot of people write set books in times and historical fiction in kind of things that we all are familiar with, but you're just going a little bit off the beaten track, and I find that really fascinating.
Well, thank you. As I said, I call them Easter eggs because to me these are gifts, and I love history. I love finding out the details of everyday life from an era I don't know about. So it really is a gift, I think, when I find out about an event like this that I didn't know about, and I can craft a story around it.
Absolutely, yeah. So, Liza, you had talked earlier about that you worked with your first agent on rewriting and so forth. How did you actually find your agents, and is it common to have an agent that early in the process that really coaches you through the rewriting?
Well, in hindsight, I can say I didn't know what I didn't know. So I was so gung-ho about getting into writing, and I was 53 getting started, and I needed to catch up. So I started, once I had my first draft, of course, I think every beginning novelist finishes the first draft and thinks, well, I'm done. Now, this is ready to be published. Right, I'm laughing now. So I wrote a query letter. I researched how to write a good query letter and started sending out queries, and I got some responses. The first one was 6 minutes later, and then some would come in later. And I got an agent who said, with a very good agency, and she was wonderful to work with, and she said, you know, this has potential, but it's not there. Let's start in on what we call revise and resubmit, meaning she was guiding the manuscript, but not, she hadn't signed me yet, and it took like 11 months before I was signed. And during this time, I was getting my MFA. I felt like I was growing as a writer, and I liked the way my writing was going as I, you know, learned and got workshopped and had advisors that I respected. So when we got to a certain round of revisions, I started pushing back. And she was not happy, and I was not happy. I wasn't the same writer she had started working with. Mm. And I didn't like her vision for where the story should go. And we parted terms. I think we were both sad. I respect her tremendously, and we keep in touch a little bit. But I knew that that I needed this story to go in a different way. You know, so yes, it was early in my process, very early to get an agent. Yes. And right. And then I sat back for a while and polished this up and thought, you know, what do I really want this book to be? And so I rewrote that query letter, changed the draft to the way I really wanted it to be, and I started over querying agents. And the agent I have now sent it out almost immediately. He said it's ready to go.
So it seems like for someone who's come pretty late to the game, you've had some pretty kind of quick successes. Now, not necessarily in publishing this book, but in finding people who are interested in your work and in publishing the essay, like the first essay that you wrote. And
Well, I have really been fortunate. Some of it is being in the right place at the right time, and I now teach seminars to teach people how to write a query letter and how to submit to literary magazines to get started, because I really believe that aspiring novelists and writers, you have to get noticed to get noticed. So you have to start small and get a small piece or an excerpt published. And then, you know, when you write that query letter, you have some credentials and some credibility. You know?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. That makes sense.
That's a great quote, that you have to get noticed to get noticed.
Yeah. Well, I was wondering now, you didn't self-publish this, though, this book. Did you ever consider that?
No. My publisher is Blackstone Publishing, and they got started about 30 years ago as a pioneer in audiobooks. And about 10 years ago, they went into publishing hardcover books, and they make a really beautiful, beautiful book.
Oh, they do.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah. Yeah, that was, you know, and that's important when someone's just browsing through the bookstore, you know, and not knowing.
Except they can't do that now.
No, they can't. And I was going to ask, so when you teach seminars, I assume they're online. Have they always been that way, or is that something you've had to move from in person to online?
I taught a seminar in writing historical fiction online on Zoom, and before that, I serve on the board of a place called Writer House, which is our local Charlottesville not-for-profit writing center. So we have classes, and we have programs with schools to teach writing and creative writing, and so I would teach. They have a physical space where writers can come and have a safe space to work privately and quietly. So I would teach there, and usually, you know, we'd have like a dozen people or so in a class, and then so the transition to Zoom is not the same. You know, people talk and they're all blocking each other out, and everybody ends up saying, what did you say? So
it must be hard. I wonder how Vermont College, you know, with the low residency if they've now moved to no residency on their MFA program?
Yeah, they have. They have temporarily. And in a way, I mean, it's hard for those students not to have that 10-day residency. But during the semester, you have the 10-day residency where you're assigned an advisor, you have workshops, you listen to author talks and things like that. And then for the rest of the semester, it's you and your advisor just communicating by computer. So, you know, it's not that big of a switch, but they do miss out on that personal interaction.
Exactly. I know some fairly well-known authors are doing these master classes now. Have you looked at any of those?
You know, I haven't, and I have seen some very tempting looking ones.
I know.
Joyce Carol Oates.
Yeah.
But right now I just don't have time. I don't have time. I'm working on the pre-publication edits of the second book, which I sort of had to put aside for these 2 weeks of launch. But that's kind of, once I get my head into that story or this story, I just have to immerse myself, really.
So you're promoting this book, which, when did it come out, or has it come out?
Tuesday, the 18th of August.
18th of August, congratulations.
Thank
now,
you.
Of course, you probably had a physical book in your hand long before that, because I know that I did. But how does it, and you can't go into a bookstore and see your book on the shelves, so the question is about how does it feel to go into a bookstore and see your book on the shelf. It's hard to launch a book in the time of COVID. You know, how...
Yes.
What's the experience been like for you?
Well, you know, I don't have any frame of reference of having it be any other way, but our local bookshop, New Dominion Bookshop, which is in downtown Charlottesville, it opened in 1924, and we have that, and we have a Barnes & Noble, and they both have big posters of my book cover in the window, and I went to New Dominion Bookshop in a mask and signed 70 copies. You know, so I had a little bit. Somebody took a picture. I took off my mask for a nanosecond and didn't exhale. So it was like a little stage setting of this is what it might be like. But
yeah.
All of my book tours canceled. I was supposed to go to the Louisiana Book Festival, and that just canceled. So hopefully next year for my second book, I'll be able to do all those things.
So to have another book come out so soon is unusual, but you were writing, I'm sure you were writing it while you were still, while this one was in process.
That's right,
yeah.
Yes. So they're a year apart, which is not unusual in historical fiction. And some writers, you know, write series. This isn't, I don't know if it's a series. I did get a two-book deal, which was great, and I'd obviously already finished Etiquette when I got the offer from Blackstone, and then my agent told the publisher, hey, she has another manuscript here, and Blackstone said, well, send it over, and a couple days later, they came back and said, we want both of them, so I was very fortunate.
Whoa.
that happened.
Yeah.
Yes, you were. Yeah.
Wow. And... when do you start book three?
Good question. I've been playing when I, you know, you have sort of a fallow period. Once you sign the contract and you know it's 14 months until your book comes out, and then there's things don't really gear up, you know, with the cover design and marketing and all that stuff. So you have a little bit of downtime once you hand in your final revisions. So I started playing with a third book that, gosh, I can't give away. If I tell you the plot, it would be a spoiler for the first book. So
oh,
I hadn't even thought about that. But it could be sort of a series. I don't know. You know, I think my publisher probably wants to see how this first one does before we talk about a third.
Right. True. How did you decide on this title? etiquette for runaways?
Well, you know, when I told you how much I love to research and find out details of daily life, so I love to buy novels and periodicals that are contemporaneous to the time period I'm writing about. So I go on eBay and I buy old magazines and novels, because in reading those, I can really get a good sense of speech patterns and slang and how much things cost, et cetera. So I bought a 1922 original copy of Emily Post's Etiquette in Society, in Business, in Politics, and at Home. And that was the first edition of that book that they're still publishing today. And in my imagination, May might have gotten a copy of that for her high school graduation. And then through the novel, she kind of refers to it as, you know, how to respond to a party invitation or whatnot.
Right. You know, it's interesting. I'm sitting here in my home office, and I have three kind of matted covers of the Montreal fashion section of the Montreal newspaper from 1932 that I'm looking at. I just, you know, would fit you. I think you would really enjoy them. I bought them at a poster shop up in Montreal a few years ago, and they're the real thing. They're not copies of them. They're not prints. They're the actual covers in color, and they have.
How wonderful!
Yeah. I'll send you a picture of them.
I'd love to see them. Yeah, I keep a big bulletin board in my writing space. And I change it depending on which novel I'm working on, with pictures of interiors and locations, and I make a playlist of music of the era, because I'm very visual and I like to sort of immerse myself, as I said. So I love looking at pictures of, like, what you're describing.
Yeah.
Sounds wonderful.
I'll definitely do that. Do you think you'll continue writing in the same era, or is there some other historical time period that's calling your name?
Well, the first one is 1924-25. The second one is 1932. And the one I'm toying with is set in the early 50s in Paris.
Oh, okay.
So, again, they've each been sparked by an event or, you know, a person, although I don't write about historical figures, but I don't really have rhyme or reason. I know some people are much better organized than I am about what they write about.
I'm still fascinated by the fact that you, like you said, you just write scenes and then put them together later. So I think that means you don't really know what's going to happen in the end.
You're exactly right, and so many novelists would hear me say that and be absolutely horrified. But I don't really have an outline. I know where the story begins, and then in both cases, it's been about three quarters of the way through the story, and I sort of will write a scene and go backwards and forwards and connect, and then they do connect some, you know, sequentially before I can move forward. But then in both cases with these novels, the ending didn't reveal itself to me until I was three quarters of the way through. And I was a little panicky about that, wondering, is this book going to end up being 800 pages? And but I kind of had to trust that process, that the character was going to make a decision or sort of lead me to the logical ending. And I say that the ending of Etiquette for Runaways is hopefully ambiguous. It doesn't tie up into a neat bow.
Well, that is true.
That's absolutely true. That's why we have a sequel, I think, right?
Right.
Now, part of the plot has to do with May looking for her mother, who had left when she was a little girl. At what point in the writing did you know what had happened to her mother, where she would be?
That came about, again, through research. And her mother's story is based on an actual case in France, a murder case. And her mother was just at the beginning when I first started the book, her mother had died, and I thought, well, I could do a lot more with it than that, you know, than the mother just dying at the farm at the beginning. Shoot,
especially,
you know,
with
she
the
needs
whole
a backstory.
Concept of runaway, you know, that her mother was really the runaway.
Yes, yes,
yeah,
yes.
So really, you get
and
that
she was
echo.
Left, you know. Her father wouldn't talk about the mother, and Meg didn't understand what if she'd been a bad little girl, or, you know, it's clearly it was scarring to a 7-year-old.
Yeah.
Oh boy. Okay. Actually, scarring her whole life, because
yes.
She, you know, she always felt like she was not good enough for this or not good enough for that, but she turned out pretty good. I'm not. Being a spoiler here, but
so just one last question because we're about out of time. But Liza, what was your earlier career?
Well, I started in fashion design. Mary Baldwin College, as May did, and I could not get out of Virginia fast enough. I went to New York almost immediately and went to graduate school at the Fashion Institute of Design and fashion design. And I didn't finish. It was a 1-year program. I didn't finish because I was hired by Ralph Lauren, and that was really my dream come true at the age of, 22. And I worked for Ralph Lauren for 3 years, and I loved it, but it was so demanding. I just couldn't keep up with it. So I moved to Nantucket, and for one marriage, I had an antique shop on Nantucket, and then I did photo styling, and I designed a line of baby clothes made out of recycled cashmere sweaters, and so, you know, I was always doing something in the design field. When my youngest daughter went to high school, I decided to go back to school and study literature. And that was how I fell into writing.
You sounds like you've had a very creative life.
Well, I've been lucky to be able to work in creative fields that I wanted to pursue.
And you've only just begun.
Yes. At the age of 60.
Well, thank you, Liza, so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Monica, and thank you, Caroline. I've really enjoyed talking to you.
And, Mom, have some closing words?
Well, I do. Actually, it's the final sentence of the book, and it's not a spoiler, but the world is it's not verbatim, but close. The world is a big place, full of mistakes just waiting to be made, but maybe, just maybe, there are some second chances, too.
Thank
Very
you.
Nice.
Thank you, Liza. Thank you, Mom. And see you all next week on Writer's Voices.
Thanks for having me.